Welcome to At the Organ, a weekly show about the classical organ and its music, heard on organlive.com every Sunday or streaming from our website anytime. Just point your browser to attheorgan.com for more information. Now, let's hear what's happening this week at the organ.
Hello and welcome back to At the Organ. I'm Brent Johnson, and in today's show, we remember organist and teacher David Craighead with an interview with one of his students, Dr. Fred Holman. Hello again, and thank you for joining me on this week's At the Organ. Back in February, some technical issues caused us to take a little break from new episodes. We extended that break into a hiatus, but now we're back with new episodes and plans for many more to come. Our website content will be back as it once was in the very near future, so we appreciate your patience, and I'm glad you joined us here today. Today is April 15th, 2012. It is disappointing to dwell on just the sad news, but our last episode we were remembering Jerry Hancock, who passed away in January. Today, we look back at another concert organist and pedagogue who died on March 26, David Craighead. David was appointed professor of organ in the keyboard department at the Eastman School of Music in Rochester, New York in 1955. There, he taught and influenced countless students for 37 years. He retired in 1992, but continued as organist of St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Rochester. To help out those of us who never got a chance to know David Craighead, I spoke with organist and composer Dr. Frederick Holman, who is a student of David's for many years. Fred joined us last week from his studio in South Bend, Indiana. I started by asking him how he first came to meet Mr. Craighead.
Well, it was a Cinderella story or something along that lines, I think. In 1972, I had been auditioning for Howard Kelsey. Being a native St. Louisan at Washington University, he said he couldn't do anything for me. Not that I was that bad, but that I was that good. He wanted to send me off to Curtis to study with his old tennis partner, and that was Alexander McCurdy. Well, McCurdy was going to be retiring the year that I would have been starting, and so that did not work out for me. I did not gain the same type of admittance to Curtis with his successor than I did with Mr. McCurdy. So the next year I went on up, actually as a last afterthought, to Rochester. My father was a woodwind player, and he would have loved to study clarinet at Eastman because of their reputation for woodwinds. So here he was in March, looking over the Eastman Bulletin, thinking that he'd like to see me go there. He had no idea about the organ department, and neither did I, and I hadn't known David Craighead from The Man in the Moon. But there was an extra audition available on March 31st, which was a day that was blizzarding in Rochester. I had never seen weather like that in my life. I felt I had gone to the moon. But I was welcomed at the school, and trudging through these drifts of snow, I was able to audition at the very last slot of the day for David and Russell. Now, this was showing my naivete and my total absence of knowledge of politics, but Charles Cordial, my organ professor, had heard through the grapevine that David was really the one to study with at Eastman, not Russell Saunders. Now, Russell's a fine teacher of great stature, but I didn't know that. So at the end of my audition, which I thought went quite well, and they seemed to too, I could tell immediately which of the two people was David Craighead, because when I told the two of them that I was told not to come to the school until, or unless that is, I could be in David Craighead's class, of course David beamed, Russell scowled, and from that minute on, I didn't really need to do that, though, at that time, because there were only, I found out later, four openings in the entire organ department. It was a huge department, about 40 students in all, and there were only four openings that fall of 1974, and they were all undergraduate positions with David Craighead. Now, David did not want to teach undergraduates as a rule. He preferred that all the people he taught first go for 4 years at Curtis, where he was a student and graduated. but he was taking on some undergraduates at that time, and in some respects he was taking some of the students on, I know, as sort of experiments, because he had admitted students from a wide variety of backgrounds and experience, and I think he enjoyed the challenge that that posed to him as a teacher as much as it did an opportunity to the students. I guess you could say I was taken under David's wing in a way that no one else has ever done for me since. He was determined from the very moment we met that I was going to be there in his class, and he wasn't going to wait for the admissions department to come through with any type of official acceptance. The very next day, he had me come to his church and took me around in this rusting out old Datsun that looked like it had been eaten away with all the salt. And he drove me around and pointed out where the dorms were and told me that's where I'm going to be living next year. He didn't seem to have any lack of confidence that I would be there.
Fred shared with us what it was like to study under David Craighead as a freshman at Eastman.
The first 3 years, actually, I was on a 3-year program. Not only did he get me admittance, but he also arranged for me to have a full scholarship. I didn't pay a penny for a thing, not even room and board, really, until I got through the master's degree. I was a teaching assistant as a master's in the theory department. I remember that the first semester I was rather shocked because even though I had come there playing doctoral level pieces, he insisted upon stripping down, so to speak, my engine and transmission. The first 16 weeks with him was very aggravating, but I endured it, and I attribute that tearing down to the strengths I have today. He tore down the technique down to the most infinitesimal level, making sure that you understood how to keep clarity and rhythm in playing so that the listener is absolutely aware at all times where the rhythm is. This is one of the great strengths, I think, that David had. It's sort of a system, but I don't think anybody's ever written it down as such. But I certainly know it, and I could certainly write it down if I needed to. But I needed that. You know, there were two organ classes at Eastman, and I could tell there was a great difference between them. They were very complementary to each other. They complemented each other well. There was the Russell Saunders class and the David Craighead class. And one of the distinctions, I think, that maybe I'm going out on a limb here, but Russell wanted everybody to learn music just the way he wanted it. And when you heard a Russell Saunders student play, it almost sounded as if they were just like any other student. David's approach was radically different. He encouraged every student to do things well and he didn't care really how you did things, especially with new music, but he had two points in mind and they were always in the forefront. He would say, "What is the composer trying to say?" And he would force us to try to find that for ourselves. And in that way, we all had developed our own individuality. And it taught us how to teach ourselves. And this is one of the greatest gifts he ever gave to me, because I have had to certainly learn a lot of things that I never knew and no one else had known since leaving Eastman. And I'm sure a lot of his other students have too. How wonderful it is to have been taught how to teach oneself. And a lot of that came from having to really literally pick up new music that had never been played or premiered before, and to make the most compelling musical impression that you can with a piece. So in David's career, there was a shift from the standard repertoire, which was a rather limited scope of less than 20 pieces, really. And then you take that and then expand upon it in the 60s and 70s to new music, and this propelled the remainder of his concert career, so that it was always had as much integrity as he, and honesty, I think, as he could put together with what he had at hand.
A bit ago, you mentioned his system for teaching new students.
Yes.
Give us a little more detail on that.
Well, he would it was extremely, like I say, extremely, well, it's taking the wind out of your sails, so to speak, to have gone through this. But what he would do is take the Orgelbuchlein, the little organ book of Bach. He would just tear it down voice by voice. He wanted to be sure that the cantus firmus, that is the melody of the chorale being set, is always heard as the cantus firmus, and that the counterpoint against it is relegated to a less prominent position, which can be altered and shaped through very small amounts of variation in timing and articulation. Some of the concepts are pretty simple. One of the easiest concepts would be that you give a little more emphasis, that is a little wider articulation whenever there is a downbeat coming, before to know a little more articulation there than you would have on a secondary beat. Let's say we have a 4-4 measure, a little more on the downbeat, a little less but still some on the secondary beat in the measure, and then a little less yet on the weaker beats, yet on beats 2 and 4. And then if there is a temporal, or that's the temporal thing, but if there is a lyrical need, for example, if there is a jump of a fifth or an octave in a voice, that requires a little more preparation temporally as well as articulation-wise, the width of articulation, compared to something that might be purely scalar or stepwise. There's, I guess you could go on like this, there's a hierarchy that I believe was there. Again, it's not been written down. A hierarchy of about 144 rules that are interrelated. There is a way of articulating, and this again applies to just clarity. It's a matter of clarity in music. This really doesn't have to do with the overall arches in music, but just about clarity and making sure that the rhythms are clear to the listener. So it has to do with the width of articulation within certain voices. And of course, sometimes voices do overlap. You have certain rules that you will follow there. In a way, this is not a new concept, because Marcel Dupré actually made quite a bit of money at it by making his editions of Bach, where there was an extensive preface in French, and I believe translated into English, according to what his rules were. Now, his rules were entirely different set. It's a totally different approach to Bach playing than David was espousing in the 70s. However, you judge each one of these systems by how effective the end result is. You can have something that goes entirely contrary to what David taught, and it can be just as convincing if certain things relate within the system. Again, you have the Dupré system, you have David's system, and even before that, in a respect, you have some by Bonnet and other pedagogues that that had their own systems. Although I think as we got into the neo-Baroque revival, which peaked in the 60s, you see more attention and more credence given to each of these systems. Today, I think we've lapsed. I don't see anybody applying a system as a of any type of articulation on a predictable level. I wish we had gotten back to that. That's one of the things I think has a chance of losing its heritage or its lineage with the passing of David and his teaching, is that who's going to carry that on? I think it's a necessary exercise for every organist. I fought tooth and nail like a dog that didn't want to go to be washed. I fought against this for weeks, and finally I broke down and I acknowledged that this is what I have to do to really get over this and to become, you know, a better organist. The system does actually help. If it doesn't, if you don't end up using it, or if you modify it, it causes you to think about these things in a detail that you would never otherwise have done. Sometimes it's the byproduct of teaching that's as valuable as the direct product.
You're listening to At the Organ.
We're speaking with Dr. Fred Holman from South Bend, Indiana, who's sharing his experiences with David Craighead at the Eastman School of Music in Rochester, New York. David Craighead passed away last month. Fred continued to talk about David Craighead's concert career.
Back in the 40s, Alexander McCurdy, who is really at the forefront in David's teaching, I think the McCurdy style, the compassion, that's part of McCurdy. And McCurdy did a lot of things. He taught at Westminster Choir College and at Curtis. And, of course, David was considered one of his, you know, really top talents that came out of McCurdy's class. And Alexander had also done a lot to almost meddle and interfere with people's lives. This was what really steered him eventually to Rochester. McCurdy also taught at Westminster, and of course Westminster was the more practical students who were going out to big church positions. They weren't necessarily headed for concert careers like the Curtis would prepare you for. Yet Alex had this idea of matchmaking now and then, and he kind of thought that Marion, one of his students at Westminster, might be a pretty good person to get together with David. And they did. And they were wed and soon before coming to Rochester. David came to Rochester when I was born about 8 weeks old. In 1955, he started at Eastman. And his career is attributed, I guess, as his concert career. He tells me that it had nothing to do, by the way, with management being so powerful. Everybody has the illusion, and so he said to me, that his success as a concert artist was due to his face being on the back page of the trade journals every month. And at that time it was Lillian Murtag, and before that Bernard LaBerge, and then of course it changed hands a few more times and still goes on today. But he said his concert career was due to the engagements that were given and booked for him by his students, present, past, and so forth. And so he had a brilliant concert career in that way. There's also something about the pieces he learned at Curtis. There were some nice show pieces. Actually, the programs, if you look back, they did have some flashy things. For example, David used to play, when he was first on the concert circuit, organ transcriptions, including the piece that I discovered only by some type of a fluke in rummaging around in the music library at Eastman. But he played the Rite of the Valkyries in the Lemaire transcription. I was shocked, actually, and so has everyone else been shocked who was with me at the Eastman then. Because in that day, in the 70s, transcriptions were considered almost sacrilege. You didn't play transcriptions. They were out of fashion, out of vogue, and they were almost considered in terribly poor taste. Yet, in the 1940s, David opened his concerts often, as anybody can look them up in the past issues of the Diapason, for example. He played the Rite of the Valkyries. Now I thought, if it's good enough for him, why can't it be good enough for me? Well, there were a lot of transcriptions of Lemaire hidden in the Eastman Library. I got hold of them in 1978, and I actually chipped away at this and learned the symphonic technique by just sheer brute application and diligence of practice. These are the same techniques that David could have shown me, but he didn't, because he probably figured it wouldn't be good to do this. This is not in our curriculum. But it came down to, I had asked him for the Rite of the Valkyries, because I knew he had the score, and it wasn't anywhere in the library. That was one transcription that wasn't there. And I said, please, David, could you give me your transcription? I know you, where you keep the transcriptions. He had them hidden away in this folder in his closet. Talk about in the closet. Well, he kept the transcriptions in the closet and didn't want them to be seen by anybody. But toward the very end of my time, he probably thought I would never come back and study with him further. I was finishing up the master's degree, and it was a nice sunny day in May. And there was a department there, the copy room, where all the faculty could copy things. They had one huge copy room, and there were a couple of big copiers. And I was in there, and he was making copies. And I said to him, you know, David, he said, Fred, oh, Fred, wait a minute. I'm making something here for you on the copy machine just right now. And he says, here, I wanted you to have this before you left. This is the Rite of the Valkyries. You asked for it a couple of years ago. And I was very thrilled, overjoyed to get this. And I said, well, that's wonderful, but why didn't you give it to me 2 years ago when I asked? And he said, no, if I hadn't have given it to you then, you would have been playing it and you wouldn't have played anything else. And then everybody else would be playing it and nobody would be playing the things they should have been practicing on, you know. And he thought it would be the demise of the department had this gotten out. So I thought that was a little bit humorous. But he did actually, in addition to the transcriptions, he did quite a bit in new music. And whereas some people in the 70s were trying to go with a heavy emphasis on performance practice, I think David's approach was too ingrained in the McCurdy style, which was not compatible with the performance practice discoveries that came about in the 70s. So what did he do? To make his way authentic and to do the best he could, he concentrated on new music. And here's an area where I think that maybe he hasn't been praised quite enough.
I see. Now, let's go back to that codified system of articulation that you were talking about. Do the rules that you learned there apply to other repertoire outside of just Bach?
It can. It depends on how you want to apply it. For example, you could take the Baroque style of clean and rhythmic articulation and apply it to other things. You can apply it in certain types of French classic literature. You can even take it as far as Mendelssohn. However, when you get into Mendelssohn, you start to there's a gray area as to where you want to continue to be so stark in your articulations. It's a matter of very finely regulated style, and it's a choice that everyone needs to make. But certainly I have taken what I've learned in the first year of being broken down, so to speak, to the bare chassis. I've applied it in all different types of music. I've applied it to, I've applied some of these elements to Mendelssohn, Vidor, even some Vierne, and even 20th century. In fact, I would say that the Austrian school of like Heiler, Planyevsky, Radulescu, those people that are active around Vienna, the contemporary music in Germany also benefits quite a bit. Even mid-century Hindemith can benefit from this type of application. And I think if you listen, I mean, I'm not saying people have to, but I certainly know that in listening to my own work, my recorded work, that I can hear very much all of this at work in the recordings I made in the 1970s and early 1980s. It still is fresh and convincing and palatable to my ear even today. I'm glad I feel that way because a lot of people have changed their mind about how to play several times and they'd really, they record it over and over and it's always a little different and perhaps not any better than the first recording. But, I do believe that it's the art of thinking about these things and applying them judiciously in outside of the Baroque that can be very effective. I wish I heard more of it today. I produce a lot of young people, and sometimes I feel that there's not enough contrast or highlight in their playing, and it would all benefit from this type of application. But often I'm going out there as a producer, I don't have the time on a production on location to tear them down for 6 months. I can tell them, let's come back in 6 months and try this, but unless the student has been proven, unless you prove to the student the real value of this, they're very likely not to want to take the time and trouble to bother with it. And that's where good teaching and strong teaching and with a strong will, but yet with compassion, is so necessary in our schools, because it can get the young people who are bucking against this to really accept it, and they'll benefit by it, I think.
That's all we have time for today, but come back next week. We'll be here, and we'll have the rest of Fred Holman's memories of David Craighead. If you're listening to our show on OregonLive.com, I hope you will be able to contribute to the Oregon Media Foundation's fundraising drive this year. During the month of April, we take some time out to ask listeners to support the station by becoming a sponsor and funding the infrastructure that makes the 24-hour free broadcast of organ music possible. Where else can you find a nonstop stream of a variety of classical organ music? I do hope you'll take some time to consider supporting the station. At the time of this broadcast, almost 80% of the operating expenses for the next 12 months have been raised, and every contribution, no matter how small, helps keep the station broadcasting. Remember our Twitter feed, where we post updates about events in history, and you can find us on Facebook. Just go to our website, attheorgan.com, for the links. Thank you for listening, and until next week, I'm Brent Johnson, and I'll look forward to joining you again at The Organ.
You've been listening to At the Organ, a weekly look at the art and music of the classical organ. We'd love to hear your comments about the show. Send your email to info@attheorgan.com, or just go to our website where you can comment on the show. There you can also hear this week's show again or find back episodes. The address is attheorgan.com. At the Organ is a production of the Organ Media Foundation. For more information about supporting the foundation or sponsoring an episode of At the Organ, go to organmedia.org. Thank you for listening, and we'll meet you here next week at the Organ.